Many of the refugees who were showing up in these refugee camps were young children who were called the unaccompanied minors. Later their name would be changed to the Lost Boys because that was more media friendly. But these unaccompanied minors, for various reasons, had ended up with no parental figures around, and so many, many women were providing care for them. And the precedent for this was the Mothers Union, which had existed in a very, very nascent form in the Dinka church, very small, but it provided a kind of social structure for women in the church and offered them a model for collective action. In 1991, the course of the war changed. It's really important to underline that in 1990, people thought, well, 1989, people thought the Civil War was going really well for the South, that the SPLA would achieve military victory. Several things changed, but one thing that changed was in 1991, the Cold War ended, the Ethiopian government, which had been supported by the Soviet Union, collapsed. That meant that the new Ethiopian government didn't like having all these refugees in its country, didn't like having a rebel army there, so they expelled them all very suddenly in the spring of 1991, in the northern summer, in July and August of 1991. Many of them ultimately ended up in Kakuma. Because the SPLA had lost its base of operations, and for many other reasons, in that year, it split along ethnic lines, so there became a Dinka wing and a Nuer wing. Nuer is another large ethnic group in southern Sudan. They turned on each other, leading to intense violence and further displacement within southern Sudan, such that by the beginning of 1992, if you were a Dinka person living especially in the Bor area, you are almost certain to be displaced. It's estimated that 75% of the East Bank Dinka population in this period was displaced. They ended up in these refugee camps in Uganda and Kenya. So I just want to focus here, for reasons of time and space, on Kakuma, this refugee camp that emerged in Kenya in 1992. It was different to be a refugee in Kenya than it had been to be a refugee in Ethiopia. For one thing, it was easier to get supplies to Kenya. And at the same time, Kenya, for a variety of reasons, was under very intense international pressure to look like a model citizen and to accept refugees. So there was, in some ways, a better quality of life in Kakuma, but it was still a very fraught life. There was inter-ethnic tension among the refugees in Kakuma, so there was tension between Dinka and Nuer, reflecting what was going on in the SPLA. At the same time, this refugee camp had been plopped down in the middle of the territory of the Turkana people, who are a pastoralist people in northern Kenya. They didn't really like the idea that they just had a refugee camp dumped down in the middle of their territory. And that the refugees were receiving preferential treatment. So there was violence between Turkana and refugees. And then at the same time, there was dwindling international support. The policies of refugee agencies call for a gradual reduction of aid to move towards self-sufficiency, but this was northern Kenya, which is a very arid region. There was no real means for refugees to move towards self-sufficiency. The practical outworking of all of these problems was that there was violence in these camps, both between Dinka and Nuer, between the Turkana and the camp residents. Because of the dwindling supplies and rations, there was poor health. And a key year in all of this was 1997. So this camp had opened in 1992. By 1997, things had come to a head. In April of 1997, there was a cholera outbreak in Kakuma. So about 100 people died in 5 weeks. In August of 1997, there was an increase of violence reflecting tensions that were going on in Sudan. And in August, in the Anglican Church, that violence in the camp led to the death of several people, including a senior Anglican priest named John Majok, who had been a key figure in the church life in Kakuma and had now been killed. And then in September of 1997, there was political unrest in Mombasa, which is the port city in Kenya where all the aid came through. There was political unrest in Mombasa that led to the curtailment of food in Kakuma, leading to more violence. So 1997 is a difficult year. How do you respond if you're a refugee? And how do you respond if you're a woman? Well, women responded by forming a new group. They called it Dietsch Nyalich, which means, Dietsch is a word that means ask, but it has the force of the word beseech. So Dietsch Nyalich is beseech God. And it was essentially a prayer group for women. And through Dietsch Nyalich, which was only open to women, that led to a prayer, fasting, and marching campaign. In April, when there was a cholera outbreak, women came together through Dietsch Nyalich to march around the hospital in Kakuma, and they, as they marched, they held up a long wooden crosses, which is sort of a key implement of religious worship. It was often compared to the bronze serpent that Moses lifted up in the wilderness, and also Jesus, who needs to be lifted up, who invokes Moses when he says that. They were calling out for help because everything else seemed impotent. These pictures are not from that time, but they are similar pictures that give you a sense of what it's like for large numbers of Dinka female refugees to be marching. And I should say that several of these pictures that I'm showing are from the collection of Mark Nickel. Mark Nickel was an American Episcopal priest who worked with Dinka communities in Sudan in the early 1980s and again in the mid-1990s before dying in 2000. But he was present for many of these things, and his pictures evoke lots of what's going on at this time. Here's another picture of, again, this is not the exact time that I'm speaking about, but you get this sense of what it's like for large numbers of women to be together in a Christian sense. So in April, they have this march around the hospital. Then in September is in response to the death of their senior priest. They begin this prayer and fasting campaign. They, in an echo of Joshua at Jericho, they walk directly around and around the UN compound, where all of the aid agencies are based in the center of the camp, and they demand that action be taken. One of the women who led this was this woman, Maria Chol Deng. Eventually, so she was a leader of this prayer group. Eventually, after marching around and around the UN compound, and the UN officials are increasingly uncertain about what's going on. They don't speak Dinka. Here's all these women with these crosses, hundreds of them marching around their compound. They agree that they will see three women as representatives. Maria Chol Deng is one of them. She says, "We fled from the war, believing we would be protected in refugee camp. We have no way to obtain food in this desert but through the provision of the UN. Now we're being killed and are near starvation. Since the UN does not help, we cast ourselves on God." And the key feature of these campaigns that happened a couple other times is that it's all women. Men are not part of this. They're not allowed to be part of this. There's the singing element. There's the praying element. This is something I haven't entirely thought through all the way, but it does seem that there's a comparison to be made, whereas in the non-Christian religion, the religion of the Jack, Nyalich, the high god, you couldn't have direct access to Nyalich. That was mediated through an intermediary layer of these Jack or Yath. But it does seem here that women, especially through Christianity, are accessing Nyalich directly. The impact of Dietsch Nyalich, this women's group, I think is manyfold. First of all, it became a networking opportunity. These refugee camps, there's this one in Kakuma that we're talking about, but there's also ones in northern Uganda. These women are in touch with each other. And in fact, Maria Chol Deng moved between these camps, beginning similar groups in response to similar situations. So it built links between women in the churches in the different refugee camps. And the key thing was that women believed that this worked. They believed that their direct prayers to God and their collective action through the church would have an impact. Maria Chol Deng, who is one of these leaders, believes that it was their prayer, their asking of God, that led to the beginnings of the peace process that began in 1998, that ultimately led to the resolution of the civil war in 2005. She said, "So many things changed after that. People were not getting killed. The Machakos peace process started. And we believe that it's because of our prayer. We will not get our country through guns, but through talks. God is the one who organized the peace process. Implicit in what she's saying is God is the one who organized the peace process in response to our prayers. And I'll just put up here, this is a prayer. So again, you know, imagine all these women marching around the camp, around the hospital, around the UN compound. They're singing, but they're also praying as well. And here's one of the prayers that was said at that time and recorded by Mark Nickel, who I mentioned earlier. Peace exists across all the earth, but the peace of Sudan is being clawed to shreds by birds. This is how such great numbers of our people die. They expire bereft of a just law to oversee the land. Black people exist in the very habitation of evil. You, peace, are you deaf or are you blind or are you mad? You, the wives of those who are still living, we are speaking to you. Peace is the life of those who have not encountered death. I am weeping, lamenting over my people who have perished. Ah, how wonderful they were. My children have all been slaughtered. They pass away with no one to help them. They are abandoned without any kinspeople. Those of you who have life, those who have wisdom, you women, have you heard? You must pray fervently for us. Pray for those who kill their own brothers. Pray for those who are sick, those whose legs have been cut off, and for the aged and for the still unborn. We are dying because of the laws of our brothers. Our brothers are trying to impose on us. They have killed our pastors with the bullet. Jesus Christ, hear me, me, me. I am a feeble person, and I am being killed by one who is powerful. So you really understand this, the force of the verb thiech, to beseech, to beg. The final thing I want to talk about is the shortest of all, and that is to think about songwriting. And these are songs that women are singing. They must come from somewhere. Songs are central to Dinka life. They always have been. It's a culture with a weak material culture because of what's available to them. And so, in fact, a key activity in many cattle camps has always been sitting around and composing songs. If you're a young man, this is what you do. You sit around in the cattle camp with your cows. You compose a song about your girlfriend, especially about your cow, about the wrestling match that you just won against your friend. And songs have always been used in religious ceremony as well. But again, and this is difficult to reconstruct, but I feel confident in saying this, it is men who historically, before this movement of religious change, were the ones who did the songwriting and the song composition. The Christian church that emerged was emerging during the colonial period in the early 20th century and then in the early independence period, had a small Dinka language hymnody that had been left behind by missionaries. So these are translated versions of some hymns from Golden Bells, which is a very popular evangelical hymnal. And there was a very small number of Dinka compositions dating primarily to the 1940s. But a key feature of the Dinka conversion, sorry, I just left it in my bag. The key feature of, yes, that's what I'm looking for. Key feature of the religious conversion that happened during the Civil War was a really just an outpouring of hymn writing. And it led in time to the production of a Dinka language hymnal. I purchased this, of course, in Sudan. The first part is the Dinka prayer book, the 1662 prayer book translated into Dinka, and the second half is the Dinka hymnal, which was assembled and published in the mid-1990s in response to all of the hymns that had been composed during the war. I'll just pass this around if you'd like to have a look at that. Careful with it, though. I can't easily get another one. And so you have all of these hymns that are being composed by women and by men. And a key feature is just how many of these songs are being composed by women. The archetypal figure in all of this is a woman named Mary Alwil Gorang Nongdit. I don't have a picture of her on the slides, but in some ways you could call her the Charles Wesley of the Dinka conversion movement. She wrote a large number of the hymns that are in that hymnal, and many of her hymns are among the most popular that are still sung today. And again, she's a person who came from a peripheral position in society. She was divorced in her case, and she converted to Christianity as a young woman in her mid-20s. She was relatively uneducated almost entirely illiterate, and almost immediately after her conversion, she began to write new hymns. And the fact that here was this new convert who was writing hymns was taken as a sign of the Spirit's power and the role of God in the conversion movement that was going on. And I would just say, as a side point here, and I was just talking to various people about this in recent days and weeks, about how we hear the voices of African Christian women. These are the voices of African Christian women. They are doing theology in the writing of these hymns. The challenge for us is, how do we hear that? It's not their problem that we don't speak Dinka. That's our problem. And it's our problem that that obstacle means that we cannot hear this theological reflection. That's maybe a larger issue, which is for a separate paper. What I just want to say here by way of conclusion is to look, that hymnal has an index at the back. And so I did some math here. This is maybe the first time I've done this since I was about 15 years old. But the hymnal is divided into two sections, what's called long hymns and then choruses, which are meant to be repeated. So you can see how many there are of each. And then, so just to look at the long hymns, which tend to be multiple verses, often with a chorus, so complex theological reflection, so about half of the hymns were composed during the Civil War. Some of the rest are translated. Of those, 57% were composed by men, 43% by women, and if you look at the choruses, the numbers are a little bit different. And then I've broken the numbers down further. Of the long hymns, there are 19 different female composers in that book, 35 men, and again, women had a key shaping role. 9 by this woman, Mary Alwiel Gorang. And the choruses, one of the men who is key to the publication of that book was called Stephen Deet McCock. And somehow, many of the choruses that he composed ended up in the hymnal. So if you eliminate those, then a larger percentage of the choruses are composed by women. Again, this is not gender parity by any means, but it is a substantial difference from what would have been the case before religious change towards Christianity. We could spend a lot of time thinking about the texts of these hymns as well. Here's one by Mary Alwiel Gorang, which is very, very popular. This is kind of like, this is like a real war horse of the Dinka Church. I'm trying to think of the English language example, but the kind that everybody knows. Let us give thanks. Let us give thanks to the Lord in the day of devastation and in the day of contentment. When we beseech the Lord and unite our hearts and have hope, then the Jock, the intermediary deity, has no power. God has not forgotten us. Evil is departing and holiness advancing. These are the things that shake the earth. That's the chorus. Here's one verse of 5. It's not that God does not have the power to deliver us, but we had to endure our punishment because of our foolishness of worshiping wood and animals. So God thrashed out sin from within humankind, and he called us to come with purity into his presence. Salvation has come. The Jock is departing with its hands tight to its side. Let us be strong. God wants to visit the earth. So by way of conclusion, I'll just say that I think this is a really rich opportunity for the study of African Christianity. The religious life of refugees presents fascinating opportunities to study religious encounter and religious change, and that we should be spending more time on this. In many ways, I think what I've talked about here is not that different from what's been studied at other parts of African Christian history, at different parts in history. It's no secret that women, in many other cases, were on the forefront of religious change, that women were able to find new opportunities and resources in Christianity that they couldn't find in their existing societal structures. But I think what's not been done is to study those same dynamics in the context of post-colonial Africa and in a paradigmatic example of post-colonial Africa, that of civil war and the displacement that comes along with it. I think it also encourages us to think again about what we mean by refugees. I think that we often think of refugees and migrants as people who are passive, who are immobile recipients of aid that we deign to give them. But I wonder if, when we think about it through religious terms, we can begin to think about war as a generative activity and not simply a destructive activity. What other religious change is taking place among refugee communities in the world today? I think there is so much to be found by asking that question. I'll just conclude with a short video, I hope this works, of religious life in South Sudan today. So this is taken on the East Bank, just north of Bor, about 2 years ago. So, the end. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Jesse.